Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, Drive-In Churches in the Constitution, Balancing the Religious Belief in Corporate Worship and Health Concerns Related to COVID-19. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Matthew T. Martins, a partner at Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr, and Mr. Hiram Sasser, the Executive General Counsel at the First Liberty Institute. After our speakers give their opening remarks today, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us. Mr. Sasser, the floor is yours.
Well, hey, thanks for having us. There's been a slew of cases that have taken place across the country involving various forms of church gatherings and religious gatherings. One of those subsets has been the drive-in church service. A drive-in church service, just to give a little bit of an explanation, is that after the various shutdown orders took place, banning, among other things, religious gatherings indoors, some religious institutions got very creative and decided that they were going to try to do something a little unique, which is to have a drive-in church service. I actually know of one pastor in Iowa who, during their drive-in service for Easter morning, it was 19 degrees in a blizzard, and yet he was outside preaching through a FM transmitter that would broadcast his message through to the radios in the cars parked in his parking lot. The first case that involved any kind of that, well, the first successful challenge to any shutdown order that we know of was for a church drive-in service, and that was in Louisville, Kentucky. Judge Justin Walker issued the decision in that case, and it was a seminal decision because it was really the first decision against any kind of particular shutdown. Matt Martins at Wilmer Hale served as our lead counsel in that case, and what I'd like to do is turn it over to Matt and let him give you a little bit of description about that case and about some of the legal proceedings there. Go ahead, Matt.
Thanks, Hiram. And it's a pleasure to be with you all today. These series of drive-in church matters is the latest in a long history of my opportunity to work with First Liberty and Hiram in particular. And I would just say that if you're interested in religious liberty issues, if you're not working with First Liberty on these things, you guys are really missing out. They are a tremendous group of lawyers and strategists, and just a pleasure to work with. I highly commend them to you if you have issues or you want to work on these issues. Hiram came to me, as he often does, with a matter on the eve of need to act. And so in this instance, we were contacted during Holy Week, right before Easter. I think it was on Wednesday. And Hiram wanted to see if we can get involved with regard to the On Fire Christian Church in Louisville, who was looking to do drive-in services, in fact, had been doing drive-in services in the weeks leading up to Easter, including on Palm Sunday, but had become concerned because of statements by the mayor of Louisville about whether or not they'd be able to continue doing that, in particular on Easter. The mayor had made statements that drive-in service wouldn't be allowed on Easter, and he specifically invoked the governor's stay-at-home order, or safer-at-home order, that carry with it criminal penalties, misdemeanor criminal penalties, if one didn't comply. And so the church was rightly concerned that they could face some type of sanction if they went forward with their Easter service. And so we wrote a letter to the mayor on that Thursday, asking him to reconsider that position. And when we didn't hear back, We filed a TRO action on Friday, Good Friday, right before Easter. And our arguments were several fold. One, we made an argument under the free exercise of religion clause, and on the ground that the order at issue, both the governor's order that was being invoked by the mayor and the mayor's statements, were not neutral with respect to religion, or stated another way, that the law at issue was not generally applicable. There was not a general prohibition against cars accumulating in parking lots. There was only a prohibition against cars accumulating in parking lots for purposes of religious services. And so under the Supreme Court's decision in Church of Lukumi Babalu I, that type of targeting of churches for a prescription that was not generally applicable is subject to strict scrutiny, and thus requiring that it had there be a compelling interest to justify it, which we were not disputing here, the COVID-19 being a serious issue in our society, a very serious health issue. But at the same time, we argued that the remedy for that here was not narrowly tailored. It wasn't a prohibition on cars accumulating generally, but only cars accumulating for religious purposes. And so there was not a tailoring of the remedy to the risk. We also made an argument under the First Amendment's Freedom of Assembly Clause. The Supreme Court has long recognized that the First Amendment Freedom of Assembly Clause includes religious assemblies in a case, NAACP versus Alabama from 1958. And here there was a prohibition on assembling. And again, we recognized the compelling government interest, but didn't see the narrow tailoring, particularly when the church was willing to take precautions to comply with CDC social distancing guidelines, to including people remaining in their cars during the entire time period, nobody leaving their car to go to the restroom, no passing of an offering plate, people keeping their windows rolled up, limited number of people outside their cars for purposes of operating the camera and the sound system and the preacher. And so we argued that the government's approach here violated the Freedom of Assembly Clause. And then we also raised state law claims under the Kentucky Constitution that mirrored those protections under the U.S. Constitution, and then also a claim under Kentucky's Little RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that provided a protection along the lines of the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, namely reinstating the compelling interest in narrow tailoring test that existed prior to Employment Division versus Smith. So those were the claims we brought, and the judge issued an opinion on Saturday in that case, right before Easter Sunday, granting our TRO, allowing the church to go forward with its drive-in church service on Easter Sunday. And then ultimately through, I think, effective cooperation and really a desire by the mayor to try to reach an accommodation with the church, we were able to successfully negotiate a resolution that allowed them to handle or to hold drive-in church going forward.
And Matt, you know, and everybody, what I find, fascinating about this is that, you know, this was, obviously the drive-in church service, but it's also leading into this next phase of the in-person church services. And Matt, you've always been very helpful to join in the fight on last-minute basis. I think we ought to tell them what's going to happen in about 30 minutes after this phone call.
Yeah, so the next phase in the litigation, as more data has become available, as we've learned more about the disease, and as we've seen where it's accumulated, we've had some churches in some more rural areas where there has not been a prevalence of COVID, seeking to hold church services in circumstances where they have relatively small congregations, but some large auditoriums. And so they can segregate people by families. So they may be in the same room, but well spread out from one another. And so we have brought a lawsuit this week on behalf of a church in a rural county in Kentucky, seeking a TRO to allow that type of church service. There are only 40 instances of COVID that have been diagnosed in a county of 54,000 people, and no deaths in that county, thankfully. And so that church is looking to return to the days of in-person church services in their sanctuary, but taking a number of precautions. And we have a hearing this afternoon, actually at 3:30, a telephonic TRO hearing, again in Kentucky, this time in a town called Nicholasville, near Lexington.
I think it's important for everybody to know a little bit about just the basic, some of the basic legal framework kind of leading up to these things. When it comes to free exercise jurisprudence, I think most people are aware that the free exercise jurisprudence changed significantly in 1990 with Employment Division versus Smith. And the holding of that case was that a law that is neutral and generally applicable would be ordinarily upheld and would not be subject to strict scrutiny. Just a few years later, the Church of Lukumi Babu I versus City of Hialeah was decided in 1993. And interestingly, the district court decision was cited in Employment Division versus Smith as an example of sort of these, you know, wild, Justice Scalia was pointing out sort of these aggressive cases that, that obviously the religious adherents should lose. In 1993, I guess I would have thought if I was representing the city of Hialeah that I've got Justice Scalia's vote in my pocket, but it did not. And in 1993, the court said that, well, if you are targeting religious activity, particular religious activity, in a way that you're not similarly situated secular activity, then the law would face strict scrutiny. And in many of these regulations that are shutting down churches and the like, they're falling. The reason strict scrutiny is applying is because they're selective in their the banning of the various sizes and types of gatherings, and there are various comparators that are out there, secular comparators, and also sometimes religious comparators, because again, like in Lukumi, one of the comparators was kosher, was a kosher exception. Or in, for example, in Gonzalez versus Ocentro, although it's a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act case, in the strict scrutiny analysis, the comparator was peyote use, which for the claimant was bringing a claim about wanting to drink an hallucinogenic tea. And they compared and said, well, you're allowing religious peyote use. So when you have these exceptions that are built into the various orders, it's those exceptions that end up triggering strict scrutiny and, in fact, drive the strict scrutiny analysis all the way through. But I think that we've basically outlined the issues and the law and some of the emerging things that are going on. This probably would be a good time to open the floor to questions people might have about either these types of cases or the in terms of the drive-in service cases or the emerging cases of the in-person service type of environment.
Okay, let's go to audience questions. We will now go to our first question. Caller from area code 417, you're on the line.
Yes, my question is on the subject of mootness. Because of the COVID quarantines, the restrictions coming down, are we doing, are we litigating these things perhaps unnecessarily because by the time they get in front of the court, the subject will be moot?
Well, I think it's a good question. Are you, if the question is whether or not they will become moot in a general sense going forward before perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court could evaluate the cases, then the answer is that may very well be true. In other words, this issue may not persist long enough because most of the cases are against state enacted shutdowns and various other rules. And so the states have 11th Amendment immunity. And so all the cases that are, for the most part, being brought are for injunctive relief only. And so it is possible that as the cases migrate through the system, that eventually they could become moot before perhaps Supreme Court review. But as we've seen with case after case, whether there was a TRO that was entered in Kansas or the one that was entered in Louisville, Kentucky, or the Sixth Circuit opinion that came out regarding a case in Kentucky, that the immediate relief that is being sought to immediately begin to have some measure of religious activities that were otherwise prohibited, not only are very real and timely, but are able to be adjudicated and relief afforded prior to the government shutdown. And we have to remember that the Supreme Court said in Elrod versus Burns that the loss of constitutional freedoms, even for a moment, is per se irreparable harm. And so it's important to vindicate constitutional rights, even if it would only be for a day. But as we've seen, it's been for weeks and maybe potentially months. Again, we just had the governor of Illinois issue a statement saying that almost until they have no one else is sick, that they're not going to allow meetings over 50. I don't know when that's ever going to happen. So maybe perhaps the Illinois cases might have enough legs to go all the way to the Supreme Court. But I think you're right. It's probably not going to go to the Supreme Court, but there's a lot of immediate relief that can be had.
Thank you.
Do you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I think you're right. It's the two points that one, the loss of even one Sunday is a loss of a religious liberty that can't be recovered. And so it is not yet moot because certainly some states are prohibiting services even now, this Sunday. And then bigger picture, I think there's an open question about whether states like Illinois intend on prohibiting church services for potentially years based on the recent statements that were made about not allowing it until there's a vaccine. So I think it is anything but moot.
Thank you. We'll now go to our next caller. Area code 305, you're on the line.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was wondering, Matt, if you pursued the religious speech angle, and I believe that there are a lot of arguments that could be made to buttress the free exercise argument. But going back to the Scalia decision and Smith, that there should be a hybrid.
To start off with about hybrid rights, I teach a religious liberty course at the University of Texas at Austin, and I always tell my students that hybrid rights exist in two places. They exist in law review articles and on law school exams. But in practice, I've never been able to find a case where you were to go to the court and essentially, and let me break down what hybrid rights are because people don't know what we're talking about. Hybrid rights claim is a claim that's mentioned in Employment Division versus Smith as theoretically available as sort of an exception to the Smith framework, such that if you had a free exercise claim plus some other constitutional right claim, that somehow they would merge together to invoke strict scrutiny. But what I've never seen is a case in which you're able to bring, for example, a claim that otherwise would not be entitled to strict scrutiny and a free exercise claim, and that somehow the free exercise claim married to the other constitutional claim elevated the constitutional analysis to strict scrutiny beyond what would have otherwise been available to either one standing alone, which is how I understood the reference to hybrid rights in Employment Division versus Smith. In other words, if you have a freedom of assembly claim and strict scrutiny is going to apply, it applies because you have freedom of assembly claim, not because you have a freedom of assembly claim and happen to have a free exercise claim. And so, or for instance, a lot of post-Smith litigation was based on the free speech clause. And for the most part, the analysis was done completely within the free speech doctrine. And free exercise, while may have been pled in the complaint, was sort of left on the back burner in terms of the analysis. Now, it is true, though, that that the freedom of assembly claims do come into play, and those are claims that we actually bring. As a matter of fact, Matt, I think you might want to pick up the ball from here and kind of explain a little bit about kind of the narrow tailoring arguments that that we're making in these cases along the lines of the freedom of assembly claim.
Right. And, you know, we are, as part of our freedom of assembly claim, we are arguing under the compelling interest test that they are not narrowly tailoring the prohibition to the identified harm. So it's the traditional compelling interest, which we're not disputing, but then arguing the narrow tailoring that there are less restrictive alternatives. And here, comparing to the numerous other contexts in which the government is allowing significant gatherings of people, significant numbers of people in the same building, or as the case may be in the church parking lot, in other parking lots. And so we're, the argument here is that they are not the stated need to prevent people from accumulating in a parking lot because they could transmit this to one another is only being applied in the context of church services. Certainly there's a speech element to that, but there's also plainly a religious element to that, to the extent that religious gatherings are being singled out. And so we focused our discussion, our litigation strategy on the singling out of religious gatherings. Similarly, now as we're starting to bring lawsuits in the in-person, in-church sanctuary context, again, the government isn't prohibiting more than 50 people being in any given building or in any given room or more than 10 or whatever line they're drawing. They're only prohibiting that in the case of church gatherings. And again, it's that type of singling out rather than a law that generally prohibits any instance in which more than 50 people are in a room. They've said you can't have more than 10 or 50 or whatever the case may be. In some instances, none, a total prohibition, people in a room at one time for purposes of a church service. And so we focused our strategy on that targeting of religion. Or stated another way, under Church of Lukumi Babalui, the absence of a law of general applicability.
We will now go to our next caller. Area code 502, you're on the line.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. Two quick questions, if you don't mind. Are these emergency TRO and PI hearings being made available to the public and press as they would be in the absence of COVID-19? And the second question is, all of these cases seem to be filed in federal court rather than state court, and why is that?
So the answer on the first question is that, yes, they are available. At least the first one we did was the judge provided a dial-in that the public could dial into. And there were, as I recall, dozens and dozens of people who dialed in, including several law professors who were live-tweeting their analysis of the argument as it was occurring. So there has been public accessibility to these, and the judge set it up so that there was a different dial-in code for the lawyers as opposed to the public at large, so that the public could be muted so that there wouldn't be any court disruption. So yes, there has been public access, even though the hearings have been telephonic. And as to your second question, as to why they're brought in federal court, generally, they've been brought in federal court because we've been advancing the First Amendment arguments under the U.S. Constitution. And so there is federal court jurisdiction to hear those, which I think helps us because obviously there's a long history of the independence of the federal judiciary as appointed for life and not being elected. And so we have taken advantage of that option that the Constitution provides us to bring the cases in federal court.
Yeah, that's a question. I live in Austin. Thanks so much for doing this. The question's about the proper approach to this, and here's a concern. there's no doubt that, you know, post 1980s onward, as the church started to show up in the courtroom and actually press for an equal treatment in the public square, that we've made progress. But what I'm reluctant to do is bring, it seems we should be reluctant or reticent to make our first tip of the spear argument the religious freedom one, and here's why. In cases like that are just religion as religion, you wind up going, it seems to me, in front of judges who do not share the same, put the same value on transcendence. And so when you have like one of the hybrid rights cases that was talked about, of like freedom of assembly or freedom of speech, you more often than not see judges who would probably, for religion, because they have a, you know, they have a, I guess, a naturalistic worldview. There's no divine, there's no other. They don't put any value in that. And same thing when you look at cases like pro-life cases that deal with the transcendent value of life. If they're a naturalist, kind of like a Darwinian evolutionist, they think there's nothing beyond the grave, then life to them doesn't have some connection to the divine. It seemed to me the best foot forward would be advance as much as possible the non-religious claims and use the religion one alongside, but hold it back until you absolutely need it, because, you know, what gets handled there by a judge who does not ascribe transcendent value to religious belief is not going to be given a fair hearing. And so we wind up getting like 5-4 decisions and we think, woohoo. But, you know, if we were to go on a speech case or an assembly case, we get like a 9-0 decision. It seemed to me that we should advance those non-secular claims first and save religion for last. I'd like to get your point of view on that.
Well, this is Hiram. I understand what you're, you know, I understand what you're saying. My pushback would be that, for example, in Gonzalez versus Ocentro, although that was a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act case that involved sort of the mandatory statutory application of strict scrutiny, that was a unanimous decision. I don't believe Justice Alito participated because he was new on the bench, but it was unanimous in its analysis and importantly in its formulation of how strict scrutiny operates in a way that's very, very deferential to religious liberty. For example, in that case, the formulation of the question for whether or not the government has a compelling interest is not, hey, does the government have a compelling interest in its general scheme of what's going on? In that case, it was, does the government have a compelling interest in prohibiting people from using illegal drugs, Schedule I substances? And the answer to that, well, of course they do, right? But that's not the question that the Supreme Court, a unanimous Supreme Court, established. The actual question that the court is supposed to ask is, what is the government's compelling interest in not providing an exception to this particular claimant? And so I do believe that, you know, you've had a number of Supreme Court decisions, whether it was Trinity Lutheran, that had a significantly had I think it was 7-2, but don't hold me to that. Hosanna Tabor, which was a unanimous in terms of the voting, and that's what I'm talking about, not necessarily joining the same opinion, but the voting. And then of course you have Gonzalez versus Ocentro. So I think that the formulation for how we address these questions, once we get over some initial threshold questions, has been fairly uniform and widely accepted. But I do take your point, which is, and it is a point that was the, I guess, what I would call the primary emphasis of religious liberty litigation, especially in the 1990s and the early 2000s, which was a focus on non-free exercise claims. But I think what we've seen is a migration towards the religious claims as a result of a number of things, but including some developments at the Supreme Court post-Employment Division versus Smith, like with Lukumi Babalu I versus City of Hialeah, with you know, Trinity Lutheran, with Hosanna Tabor, with sort of, even though it's a RFRA case, you know, the discussion of the analysis in Gonzalez versus Ocentro. And so I think we're going to start seeing a further entrenchment of bringing the free exercise claims for religious activity, because that was the clause that was meant to protect that religious activity.
Yeah, this is Matt. I would sort of just add two thoughts. One, we've been doing, my firm and I have been doing religious liberty litigation, advancing free exercise claims with Hiram and his folks at First Liberty. I've been doing it with them for 6 years, and we've never lost a case. So I have not yet seen an inability to press free exercise claims effectively in the courts. And if I did have concern about that, my second point would be, to me, that would be all the more reason to press them rather than just revert to First Amendment free speech claims. I don't want to see the free exercise clause go the way of the dodo bird. I want to continue to press it, even if I believed it was more challenging to do so that we could continue to develop the law and develop a vibrant body of case law, ensuring the free exercise of religion for future generations.
Well, something else I think that's important that we sort of talk about and explore is that one of the Supreme Court decisions that a lot of people have pointed to is Jacobson versus Massachusetts. It's a 1905 Supreme Court decision dealing with mandatory vaccination for smallpox. And the Supreme Court had a lot of things to say about a statute. And by the way, this was a statute that was passed in Massachusetts. It was not a sort of the, you know, executive, state level executive orders, which are, you know, somewhat unprecedented in terms of the scope and scale of what we're seeing now. But in that case, the Supreme Court said that, you know, certain types of objections, whether it be psychological or religious objections and those sorts of things, would not be the type of objections that would overcome the state's interest in preserving the health and safety of the population by forcing smallpox vaccinations. I think it had some language in there about if you had, you know, they're not saying if you had a health-based reason why you could not receive that, you were in some sort of fragile state or something like that, that their opinion was not to be taken as that would not be a valid reason to raise. But what's gone on is that the governmental entities that have passed these and raised these executive orders have taken Jacobson as sort of this license. And the, like the argument that was presented in our Louisville case with On Fire Christian Church versus the City of Louisville, that Judge Walker presided over, the other side made the sort of broad argument that Jacobson essentially means that the Constitution is on vacation during a pandemic, and that the government sort of has a free hand to suspend constitutional rights in whatever means that they so choose. And certainly, you know, the admonition that the Constitution is not a death pact is relevant, but the it is not dispositive of all constitutional claims. The Constitution is indeed not on vacation, as the Sixth Circuit pointed out in the Maryville emergency appeal, that Jacobson is there, and it's not that it's not good law, but it's not, doesn't stand for this broad proposition that the government can kind of just do whatever it wants to do under the guise of, well, it's a pandemic. And in fact, that there are certain limitations. But whatever those limitations are, we haven't really even fully scratched the surface when it comes to the religious assembly cases, whether it be the drive-in service or the in-person service, because they're not, the various orders around the country are not doing complete shutdowns of everything, whereby they're, you know, the equivalent of what happened in Wuhan, where they welded the doors shut of everybody so that they could not exit at all. In fact, we're allowing all kinds of activities. Those other activities that are allowed can serve to varying degrees as comparators to the prescribed religious activities. And so what the there was nothing like that was presented in Jacobson, whereby there would have been, imagine in Jacobson, there would have been a whole slew of a number of exceptions. Of course, Jacobson preexisted our strict scrutiny jurisprudence, to be sure, but even still, taking it on its face, we're not talking about asking for relief to engage in activity that's not equivalently being asked and allowed to be engaged in from a secular standpoint.
Thank you. Let's now go to our next question. We have three or four in the queue.
I guess more towards what you were saying as far as the overreaching executive, where Justice Bradley in Wisconsin, had said that the people of Wisconsin had no intention of giving one unelected official so much power to force, 6 million people to stay home. So expanding, the religious liberties issue to a more broad issue of controlling just out of control pandemic orders. Do you see any litigation or any case law or anything that can be used to go against an executive that just, really doesn't care about constitutional orders? It doesn't seem so much that the federal government is doing it, but it's more on the local basis where you're seeing a lot of these governors just completely outstepping anything, pushing a pandemic button. And in New York, we had the unique case where the courts themselves were closed and they would only take emergency applications. Do you see any way of getting an emergency application in to just lift the order, outside of the compelling interest test? Is there anything that would force that compelling interest, quote unquote, into a court to say that this has no scientific basis, and the fact that you're able to lock down everyone in a state is beyond the compelling interest test without, pretty much any level of scientific evidence? Is there any way to get that scientific evidence in a justice ability case where the court can decide whether that scientific evidence actually carries the weight of a lockdown? And I'll take the answer offline.
Well, I think that the question you're posing actually raises a more fundamental issue. One, frankly, that the federal society has been at the forefront over the years, which is what is the proper role of courts and what is the proper role of the elected branches. I mean, ultimately, for any of the decisions made by whether it's the governors or legislatures supporting the governors with regard to these stay-at-home orders, there's political accountability for elected officials who make judgments that the people disagree with. And that'll be resolved in some states this November or in my home state next November. At the same time, some things aren't left to the elected branches. Ultimately, the courts have a final say, and religious liberty is where we have been focusing our litigation. We have not been focusing our litigation on a broad-based assault on the rights of the political branches to exercise the police power of the state and to be held politically accountable for that. We've been focused more on the singling out of religious activities to bear a burden that other activities are not bearing in these unique times.
The only thing I'll add is that I think that what you'll see in at least the religious liberty litigation context is that there are no cases that are challenging the epidemiology of the and those justifications. Simply, there are cases where there are identifiable secular exceptions, and yet the religious activity is being prohibited. And it's in those scenarios in which, at least for, I can't speak for, you know, all the religious liberty litigation that's going on, but for most of the religious liberty litigation that I've seen going on by either First Liberty Institute or other organizations, they have focused in on avoiding those fights over the science and simply using the traditional secular comparators.
Yeah, and Hira makes an important point. We have not been challenging, and we wouldn't challenge the seriousness of the disease, the need for the government to act. That has not been the focus of our litigation. The focus of our litigation is the degree to which there's been disparate treatment of religious activities. We think that that is the judgment that the Constitution doesn't allow, to place a unique burden on religious activities that is not placed on similar or analogous secular activities. And in instances where states or cities have done that, singled out religious activities for unique burdens not borne by other analogous activities, we have brought lawsuits to vindicate that principle.
Caller from area code 562, you are on the air.
Good afternoon. This is Bill Brown from Orange County. The question I had was, during confirmation hearings this week before the Senate Judiciary Committee, several of the Democratic senators criticized Judge Walker for not having heard from the defendants before he granted the TRO in the case. And I just wanted to see if either Matt or Hiram could comment on whether that's a fair criticism of Judge Walker.
Well, I think it's a very unfair criticism for a number of reasons. First, we sent a letter to the mayor on Thursday asking for an answer by the end of the day as to whether or not they would allow a drive-in church service. And the mayor refused to answer. Senator McConnell sent him a letter. He didn't answer Senator McConnell. We then had several communications with them through our filings, sending them to them, talking to them on the telephone, attempting to make sure that they had all the information and that we could receive some sort of response. They, for whatever reason, chose not to file any sort of response or even a notice to the court that they intended to file a response. So I think that given the delay in receiving the information from the mayor and no correspondence from them, forcing us to obviously work through the night to get on file on Friday, and then having all of that time and the correspondences that went back and forth all the way through Saturday morning and into Saturday without ever filing any kind of notice with the court that they intended to file a response. I with Sunday approaching, it was Easter Sunday coming. The lack of a response was unusual, but ultimately in Louisville's lap.
Yeah, I would just add on to that. It was publicly reported that we filed a lawsuit and we were in contact with the mayor's counsel on Friday, even though the law didn't require us to give them notice that we had filed. And the electronic filing system of the federal court stood open on Friday night and Saturday morning had the mayor wished to file anything. He chose not to do so, but that's his choice. That's not the judge's fault.
Okay, we'll now go to our next caller.
Hi, there's actually two people here listening. I'm Matthew, my wife is Bridget. We actually went to the fire on that Easter Sunday, so we're very thankful for the work here.
Thank you very much. It was a delightful event.
Our question was, a question we had kind of at the time, which was the way that the case depended so much on things like liquor stores being open, What stops governments from just making no exceptions so the laws are ridiculously stupid, but they're not discriminatory?
Yeah, so I guess what we're trying to say is, you know, the church was allowed to open in part because, you know, things like drive-through liquor stores were allowed, so it was clearly discriminating against churches, or seemed to be. But, you know, this problem also came up in the Hobby Lobby case, where essentially if the government is completely totalitarian and repressive, it's not discriminating against religion. So, you know, I think Matthew's question was, is this why Employment Division versus Smith is just kind of ridiculous, or your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah.
Sure, I'd be happy to start out there and Hiram can jump in. So I think that certainly the Employment Division versus Smith decision was a setback for religious liberty. It was a change of what had been decades, at least decades, if not nearly a century of law in the religious freedom context. And so it has created difficulty in advancing religious liberty claims to some degree. I would note that the Supreme Court currently has a case before it, and Hiram can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe they granted cert to consider the question of whether Employment Division versus Smith should be overruled. But you are correct that under Employment Division versus Smith, to the extent that there are broad-based rules of general applicability with no exceptions, that presents, gives the government more leeway when it comes to religious liberty claims. On the other hand, there aren't a lot of laws that don't have exceptions that implicate religion. And so to the extent that they start making exceptions, and there are often exceptions to laws, because very few things can be addressed without exceptions, then once they start making exceptions, it's no longer a law of general applicability. And so we go back to the compelling interest standard that existed prior to Employment Division versus Smith. And so while Employment Division versus Smith was a bit of a setback in religious liberty litigation, at least my experience has been, it has not been insurmountable because most laws have exceptions. And then once they have exceptions, they can't fail to make an exception for religion, absent a compelling interest in narrow tailoring. I don't know if Hiram, you have anything else on that?
Yeah, what I'll add is that oftentimes in litigation, a tactic for the government to, whether it be a free speech case or religious liberty case, is for the government to, what I would refer to, it's analogous to the scenario that you're describing, is close the forum. Like, for example, I've got a case going on right now against the United States Post Office. They allow you to put anything you want on a custom stamp. You can make custom stamps. You can order your family picture on a custom stamp. But if it's anything that's religious, such as like the stamps that they themselves make, then you're not allowed to do that as a custom stamp. And so in response to our litigation, the post office is proposing a regulation to not do custom stamps at all, right? And so that can be a significant issue. There are two responses to that. Sometimes there are other constitutional claims that allow strict scrutiny to be invoked, regardless of the fact that they have no exceptions. And then secondly is that the more totalitarian and extreme the order is, that, you know, I mean, part of federal society is that, you know, it's not courts to have to micromanage all this stuff. And you know, there's political pressure involved, too. And so the more extreme it is, the more political pressure and more alliances that can be formed in order to overturn the law in the first place. The reason many times these laws have exceptions, it may not necessarily be because it was the most logical thing or because quote unquote science says so. It could just be their lobby was really good for that industry. And so extreme totalitarianism has the same effect as all kinds of other extreme persecution. The more extreme it gets, the less the people will politically tolerate it.
Thank you. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello. This is my second crack at the apple here. I'm just trying to convince you to take a religious speech argument, I suppose, and to couple it with your free exercise argument in particular. you could, if you made the pre-religious speech argument, you could avail yourself of the prior restraints protections against the government and require them to, they have to have a judicial determination. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, prior restraint arguments in religious liberty cases in general are, you know, prior restraint speech arguments are very, very effective for a variety of reasons, not the least of which, because even though in some circumstances you may only be able to avail yourself of, an like United States versus O'Brien intermediate scrutiny analysis, even the cases interpreting that say that you have to have your, you know, what's called pre-enactment evidence that was considered by the actual government entity enacting the regulation in order to be able to justify that prior restraint on speech. So those are really effective arguments in various contexts. And don't read my comments to suggest, because we have, in fact, in our cases, free speech claims as well. The only comment that I think we were making is that, you know, the free exercise clause was meant to actually protect religious liberty. That's what this religious exercise is. And we're trying to, in some sense, restore the meaning of the word exercise. In 1990, after the Employment Division versus Smith, the word exercise became synonymous with belief, and I don't know how to square that with the fact that I've always understood, and I think our founders understood, the word exercise meant doing things, not believing things. You can't think about getting in shape. You have to exercise. You have to do things, and I think it's a worthy effort to restore the meaning of the free exercise clause, especially during a time when religious liberty is under a significant amount of government pressure that kind of came out of nowhere, in a sense, that it just, that we weren't anticipating this type of scenario happening just even a few months ago.
Okay, let's go to another question.
I was just wondering, you've talked a bit about the free exercise implications of exemptions being granted to certain organizations and non-religious organizations. I was wondering what the ramifications of things like we see in New York City, where it seems like there aren't very many exemptions being given, but we hear rhetoric from politicians that indicates that for law enforcement purposes, they're looking more closely at certain religious groups. We saw that with the mayor sort of indicating that he was paying particular attention to Orthodox Jews and Jewish religious organizations with regards to whether they were in line with the practice or not. Does that carry implications for any of this, or am I thinking sort of outside the scope for that?
No, I think it does. I think that a law you can get strict scrutiny, I think, in two different ways. One, if the law is written in a way that creates exceptions but doesn't create a religious exception, then it's not a law of general applicability and thus subject to the strict scrutiny standard. I think similarly, the case law suggests, including with Church of Lukumi Babu'i, that if there's intentional targeting of religious activity, even if a statute is written neutrally, but it's being applied in a way to intentionally target religious activity, you can likewise get the strict scrutiny under in that manner. And so I think you are thinking about it correctly.
Okay, let's go to our final caller.
Thank you. Speaking about the On Fire case itself, is the agreed judgment that you obtained in that case sufficiently broad to effectively protect all the other churches and religious bodies in that district, or would each one of them essentially have to bring their own case?
Well, we did not seek a class certification and or otherwise seek what I would call a facial invalidation as such. We presented our case as applied, and in fact, the order would only apply to On Fire. But as with all types of cases, once the the precedent has essentially been established, and I don't mean in the sense of binding precedent that Judge Walker's TRO opinion would be binding on his fellow district court judges, but to the extent that once a judge has ruled on one of these issues, on almost all circumstances, the government will obey it as if it is an injunction that applies to their actions vis-a-vis all other religious institutions.
Hiram, Matt, do you want to say anything in conclusion before we close up today?
Well, I want to say something just about Matt and Wilmer Hale. I mean, the fact that those folks in the middle of this pandemic are willing to, you know, work through the night on religious liberty cases are an inspiration to a lot of private practicing lawyers. And we work with a lot of firms on a wide variety of cases. And they're all just a great inspiration to people who want to get involved in these types of cases. I think we have a special duty as lawyers to be the first guardians of the Constitution. We have a system of checks and balances in place that are important. We have the ability to go to court to challenge the actions of various executive or legislative bodies. And that's how we keep peace. That's how we keep order. And I think these are important functions. And it's encouraging to see folks like Matt Martins who step up to the plate to participate in that.
And I would just say, as I said at the beginning, that you should be thankful for groups like First Liberty, who are out there every day doing this. I have the pleasure and the opportunity to work with them from time to time, but they're out there fighting the fight around the country day in and day out. And we should be grateful for them. And Hiram would never ask for this, but they're worthy of your support, and you should consider that. Whether that's helping as a lawyer or helping financially, I think they're a worthy organization. I also say that I couldn't do any of what we've been able to do with First Liberty without some really incredible associates at the firm who jump into these matters. And in particular, one of my colleagues, Kevin Gallagher, has been a mainstay in the cases that I've been working with First Liberty on for the last 6 years. And they really carry the laboring oar many times, and frankly, most of the time. And so grateful for other colleagues at the firm who jump in and help on these matters.
Well, we wish you both luck today in court, and thank you more broadly for your efforts on this front. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.